Everybody wants to be famous. I'm calling the shots. So, see you over a month.
SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Enough! Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
From the University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Symposium. Good morning. Live in Tucson, Hammer with us, and boy, talk about the sharp timing. There you go. There's Alan Foreman with Mandy Minger. Talk about a meeting of the minds.
You know, I saw Alan last night, and he upset me.
Because he looks so good?
No,
Because he still looks like he's 47 years old somehow?
No, because, you know, I was going to drive here so I could throw my golf clubs in the back of the car. The first thing I asked him, I said, did you play golf? Are you going to play golf? He goes, yeah, I play today and I'm playing tomorrow. I said, I knew it. And I didn't bring him, and so hence I'm not playing golf, and he's going to go out and play golf again.
Well, golf clubs are readily rentable.
Yeah, but it's never the same. I have a very unique set of clubs that anyone that's ever played with me will attest to.
Do you have like assembled pieces over the years?
I don't really use irons, so I have these.
I'm the exact opposite. I don't use wood
that nobody has. So anyway,
that's live.
So I do work out here. It isn't just play.
There you go.
But I had major shoulder reconstruction a year ago.
I didn't think
I'd ever play golf again. So to come out here a year later, having rebuilt my shoulder and be able to play. And actually, when we go out on the course, it's a good opportunity to talk business.
That's true. And network a little bit
and talk through some of the issues that we can't do with 500 people sitting out here.
And we got to keep that there in theory going. It's been going for about 100 years.
I've been doing it. This is my 38th symposium.
Of the 48.
48. Well, the symposium started, I believe, in 1974. I came out 9 years later when I became general counsel to the National HBPA. And so since 1983, I've been coming out. I missed two, one for the birth of my youngest son and one for the passing of my father-in-law. Other than that, I haven't missed one.
Wow.
So
I've
seen the industry change and the leadership of the industry change and the ownership of racetracks change and leadership of horsemen's groups change, and we're in a far different place today than we were when I started coming out here.
Well, then you've seen the ebb and flow of the symposium itself.
Oh, absolutely. You know, probably 4 years ago, I guess there was concern as to whether it would even continue. So Bob Hartman and Phil O'Hara have just done a staggering job in rebuilding the symposium. It has this feel this year of the old days.
And it almost was there last year, but I agree with you 100%. It went over the top this year.
There was still some post-pandemic malaise
that
prevented some people from making the full commitment. Because it's an expense. You got these international outlets setting up trade show type booths, and anybody listening that's ever been to any kind of a trade show, or been involved in one, that entails, including, for instance, the historic gaming machinery that the assorted manufacturers actually send here physically, sitting right by us. So yeah,
but that's how it's changed, because in the 80s, 90s, there was no gaming. We didn't talk
that's
about
true.
This. It was all horse racing and simulcasting and the new technology for simulcasting and now we're out here looking at all this gaming equipment around here and all these innovations and sports betting, and the racing part of it almost is non-existent in the exhibition hall.
Well, and the technology portion, even among the traditional vendors, that how they've incorporated. It's almost a minion.
I told him, come on over. Steve wants to see you, Joe.
Gang's all here.
We were acknowledging you yesterday with the winner that you pinhooked, the stake horse over the weekend.
Over the weekend, Todd Sherrow? No.
Really? You were involved with Todd Sherrow too?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
There's another one that you
so many winners from off the hook that we can't even count them all.
The great Joe Applebaum, everybody joining Joe and with Alan here and Hammer as we get started. Really, the first full day last night, a really jam-packed because there's 550 registrants. Last night's action just packed in here for the reception, and you mentioned the regulation, Alan, and that is the hot button topic. Later this morning, Lisa Lazarus, the CEO, of course, of HISA, she's got a keynote address. There's also a HISA address. The keynote is actually coming. Speaking of technology and broadcast innovation, Mike Mulvihill from Fox is going to be the keynote here in about an hour. And of course, Fox has been invaluable with the Fox broadcast seasons at Saratoga and the rest of the year based out of New York. The big topic, though, Alan, it will continue to be the legalities involving HISA tomorrow, the oral arguments in the Sixth Circuit. We talked yesterday with Pete Eckebert and with Eric Hamelbeck. Sure. We got his side. I want you to address your expectations. However, the interloping news over the weekend, McConnell seemingly rallying to the defense of the industry by some people's view, trying to make a administrative and congressional fix, and even bigger than all of that to me was the Mary Scolay, I don't even know what to call it, the time bomb that was basically planted the other day, telling horsemen and veterinarians and owners, well, you better be ready because there's not going to be any grace period with these new rules, so good luck. Come on.
All right, so you got a lot of questions there. And there isn't a person who hasn't come up to me since I've been out here who hasn't asked me, well, what's happening with HISA? What do we do? What's going on? What do you think? And I think that is probably the major topic of conversation among the group. So I think I was on your show two or three weeks ago, and you asked me to explain how I thought this was playing out legally. And it's a very complicated situation. I know your guests from the HBPA don't know where this is all going.
Well, they know where they're going. They know what their course of action is. They are single-minded, and good for them.
Yeah, they're going to continue to pursue the litigation, and it isn't just a resolution of the issue of the non-delegation clause. They've raised a number of other issues.
Yep.
As well known, our group is not participating in the litigation. We view that our best interests on behalf of our members, and we have a substantial portion of our membership that is supportive of a national uniform program, a national uniform safety program, and one for medication. We've been fighting for that for years.
Of course.
The devil's always in the details, but we've been committed to uniformity, and so we have felt that it's in our members' best interest to be prepared for HISA, that we think that HISA, at least up until the Fifth Circuit ruled, is a reality, and that we can best serve our membership by ensuring that they're prepared for it, that they understand what the rules are, and that the transition is smooth. And I've always taken the position that, at least with respect to those who participate in the Mid-Atlantic Strategic Plan to reduce equine fatalities that has been so successful and whose HISA safety program is modeled after it, that it isn't going to be a heavy lift. Let me start with the litigation first, and then I'll go to the concerns about Mary Scolay. As we all know, the Fifth Circuit ruled that the HISA statute was unconstitutional because it gave too much power, essentially, to the HISA, and little to no oversight authority to the Federal Trade Commission. Essentially, the Federal Trade Commission is a rubber stamp for whatever HISA recommends to them to adopt. And the way the system works is that the entity HISA drafts the regulations, gets input from the industry, sends a final set of regulations to the Federal Trade Commission, and under federal guidelines, the FTC publishes the regulations, asks for input from any interested party, the stakeholders, the public, and then based upon those comments, gives a final nod or can send the regulation or a regulation back to HISA to further consider. They can reject or they can approve. Our historical experience over the past year, which has been essentially the safety program, is that the FTC has been a rubber stamp. And in fact, the Fifth Circuit in their ruling basically concluded that there is no meaningful oversight being given to the FTC. They're basically waving it off and they're letting the agency make the decision. And that to the court was what is wrong with and why it's a violation of the non-delegation clause, because essentially Congress is just shifting over its responsibilities and oversight responsibilities to a private entity. We have always believed, based upon the work that was done to put HISA together, that it was constitutional, that it was designed after an existing system, FINRA, the law that regulates the securities industry and stockbrokers. We were modeled after that, that since we were in compliance with what FINRA does, that we would pass constitutional muster. And I've said many times on the show that I believed it was constitutional based upon the work that was done with the attorneys who put HISA together. We've had a change in the Supreme Court. We've had a change in the circuits. Some have become far more conservative. And so it was not out of the realm of possibility that a circuit like the Fifth Circuit, which is the most conservative in the country, would find a problem with it. And the Supreme Court, as we all know, ruled back earlier this year that the SEC's delegation of power to the SEC as it related to enforcement was a violation of the non-delegation clause. So there's law out there that a court could rely on to throw this thing out. Now, there's a parallel case in the Sixth Circuit. There are 12 circuits across the country, and they can differ. And when they differ is typically when the Supreme Court has to step in and play referee and decide, okay, there's going to be one set of law here, regardless of the disagreement among the circuits, and this is what it's going to be. And so the question is, we've got this Fifth Circuit decision. Where does it go? Well, there's a parallel case in the Sixth Circuit. And the Sixth Circuit includes Kentucky. So it's a major court, and it is hearing arguments, I think, today.
Wednesday.
Tomorrow. With almost a virtually identical challenge to the violation of the non-delegation doctrine. And that lower court had found HISA to be constitutional. If the Sixth Circuit, after hearing arguments, and they've got a couple of very conservative members hearing this, determine that HISA is unconstitutional, then you have two circuits that have agreed that it's unconstitutional, and that's a game changer.
Is that Yahtzee?
That what that does is it at least sends a message to the other states that, hey, two circuits have found this unconstitutional. You might want to talk to your attorneys general and find out whether or not they would agree that HISA is unconstitutional. And it may be the Supreme Court decides, well, there's no conflict here. Why should we take this case? In which case, then we really have to make a determination as to whether or not we think it's constitutional. If the Sixth Circuit disagrees, and if the Sixth Circuit concludes that HISA is constitutional, then you have a conflict that could take this now up to the Supreme Court, because of the national scope of this law, it creates just tremendous confusion. But there's no guarantee, number one, that the Supreme Court will take the case. They don't take every case. And number two, they may take the case and may use this to further what they said in the SEC case earlier this year. So, you know, they may clarify the situation. The third option, which is the one that you just raised, Steve, is that there's some feeling that you could moot out all this argument about the non-delegation clause by just going back to Congress and getting Congress to fix the HISA statute to essentially give the Federal Trade Commission more oversight power, less to HISA, and that solves what the court said was the problem with HISA in the first place.
Has anybody heard from the FTC? Because for one of the things that Eric Hamelbeck has talked about is that the FTC really could care less about this whole concept, and that we would be better under the USDA and having an agricultural element in here that would, you know, have some sort of a commonality.
Well, when HISA was put together, the question was, what federal agency do you put HISA under? One was the USDA, one was Federal Trade Commission, and it was the experts who recommended Federal Trade Commission. But you've hit the nail on the head. The biggest problem, whether it's agriculture or whether it's the FTC, is what expertise do they have in horse racing? And are you comfortable with a federal agency that knows nothing about your sport, nothing about your business, making your rules, notwithstanding that you have an entity below that supposedly will educate the agency as to what is best? But it's open season when you start asking a federal agency, even a state agency. I'd have the same concerns with a state agency making rules and policy for an industry they know nothing about. Now there's Joe's over here.
There's
Joe. This is right in Joe's wheelhouse. So
can you say oversight board?
and let me give you a difference. The sense was that FINRA is constitutional because the Securities and Exchange Commission, their expertise is in the securities field. The FTC, on the other hand, is not comparable to the SEC because they have no expertise whatsoever in our space. And, you know, I happen to be one of those over the years who, there's been a lot of argument that people who are involved in the racing industry should not serve on racing commissions, and that the racing commission should have independent members who are not connected to the industry. And I've always felt that's a mistake, because you want people who know and understand our business. Yeah, you watch out for the ethics concerns and the conflicts of interest, but you want people who understand our business making important policy. And you could end up with a situation where the Federal Trade Commission, which knows nothing about racing, is making policy. Now, it's a double-edged sword, because to the extent that some people feel that when they go before CISA, they're not getting a fair hearing, that they can, you know, you go to the FTC, you've got another a chance to make your arguments and perhaps get something changed, which is the way state government going before a racing commission is supposed to work, as a rule works through the system, or RCI, whatever. Maybe there's a good part of that practice, because it gives us the opportunity to disagree with HISA and make our case to an independent body and perhaps prevail. At the end of the day, I will tell you that with all this going on, we've been working with HISA, as I indicated earlier, and we found them very receptive. We've been able to get change. We've been able to open their eyes to some decision-making that they've made that we don't think is in the best interest of the industry, and we've been successful. And that's the way we think going forward, assuming that HISA is going to be the law and that we are going to work with HISA, that you establish that relationship.
Well, I want to use that as a jumping-off point and to segue to practical application, because obviously the legalities are going to move forward, the wheels of justice are going to grind away. And we'll deal with whatever the ultimate reality and legal decisions are. In the meantime, you got to discuss this. The Mary Scolay time bomb that was planted. This is your new Bible. This is like the Viet Cong with a indoctrination camp. You could laugh. Go ahead.
Look, there's a starting point here, and that is that the statute requires HISA to essentially blend our existing medication guidelines with international guidelines, and we actually have to follow international guidelines. We don't have a choice in that. There is a narrow exception that if it's in the best interest of, or a case can be made, that for racing in the United States, the rule or the guidelines should be different. HISA does have the ability to modify. And we have a scientific advisory group. They're very qualified, that we have essentially asked to try to work with, and with Mary and others, to try to blend those two together in a way that works for racing in this country. a perfect example is the international standards do not allow the administration of non-steroidal drugs within 7 days of a race. Okay, in this country, it's 48 hours for phenylbutazone. Under the statute, we would be required, unless a case could be made otherwise, to withdraw non-steroidal use in this country to 7 days before a race. Remember, 3 or 4 years ago, we were at 24 hours. It was a major shift. We went to 48 hours. And that was all coming out of the fatalities at Santa Anita and in the Service Navarro case that we needed to, because the examining veterinarians pre-race said that, you know, if you kept it at 24 hours, we still have problems when we're examining these horses before we go to the starting gate. But if you back it off to 48 hours, we think you helped to solve that problem. We have a better ability to detect lameness before a horse goes to the starting gate. So Joe's leadership and the THA and a number of others, we argued very strongly to Heise that if you go to 7 days, it's just going to cripple North American racing. And the reason they're at 7 days in Europe is not, has nothing to do with the health, safety, and welfare of the horse. They don't, they're very concerned about foods in their food chain, and they eat horse meat in Europe. And so they wanted, they want these drugs out of the food chain. Nothing to do with safety and welfare. So we argued to Heise that, look, this is a safety and welfare issue for our horses. We've extensively studied this, and it's in the best interest. And we convinced Heise to do that, which now leads to the Mary Scolay problem. But it's not a Mary Scolay problem.
We don't want anyone taking Alan and somehow using that coupling of words out of context.
So what they've harmonized. What they've done is they've harmonized the international rules and our rules. In our rules, we use withdrawal time guidance.
This is what I want you to explain: the withdrawal time and threshold construct versus detection times, sure, and screening limits, because it all boils down to this essentially, and there's not going to be any safety net. There's no ability for anybody to adjust to this. That means the vets don't have any, you know, how can they advise their clients, their horsemen? How can any decisions be made? And today's December 6th. This starts January 1st. Alan?
So you've hit the nail on the head, Steve. And actually, you've done a pretty good, very simple layman's explanation.
Well, I'm a simple layman.
Of the problem. But we've all been talking about it for some time and with some frustration. Under our current system, we've done, because it's what the industry wanted, we give withdrawal time guidance to horsemen. We essentially say, look, this is the level at what we're going to test, and this only relates to the controlled therapeutics. Okay, these are the drugs, medications that are used on a daily basis for the health, safety, and welfare of a horse. We're not talking about medications and drugs that are outside of that.
Right.
That could be performance enhancing. And we give guidance to our horsemen. We tell them, you know, here's the dose. If you give this dose at this time and you withdraw that administration at a particular time, you do not run the risk of a positive test. And we've been following that. And you know, we have dozens of positive tests during the year. They're medication management errors, but nothing that we believe interferes with the integrity of the sport. The internationals don't give that guidance. They don't believe in that guidance. They use detection times for certain drugs and screening limits. When you get to the more serious substances, those that are not in everyday use, they use screening limits, which means the laboratory can find it. It's a positive test. When you get to detection levels now, the detection level is the level at which it has been determined above that level that substance could have an impact on the horse, and it's forbidden. But it doesn't have a safety factor built in. So you take the way we regulate medication in this country, you take the detection level, and then you build a safety factor in because of the variability of horses and the way they metabolize substances.
Exactly.
And we have a safety factor. The international rules don't provide a safety factor, and that's where the rub is, because when you see, for example, I just said phenylbutazone, 48 hours. That, when the new rules go into effect, that 48 hours does not have a safety factor. So 48 hours is going to be something more than 48 hours. It's not going to be 7 days. It's not going to be 4 days. Most likely going to be somewhere between 48 and 72 hours. But that's the point that I think Mary made in her piece, which we're having a difficult time with because we want to be able to help our horsemen and veterinarians. What Mary and Heise is saying is, Now, you go, you veterinarian and you trainer, you sit down and you figure out amongst yourselves what you think is a safe time to do this without running the risk of a positive test. And that, to me, is a, I understand that's the way the internationals work. I understand that's the way the new system is supposed to work, but it's a bit of a gotcha. And our concern is that on day one, without massive education to the industry, that we run the risk of horsemen trying to comply who will fail because they'll get a positive test. And under the new rules, the owner will lose the purse. Whether it's a first time and, you know, we're just trying to adjust to the system. And, oh, by the way, it's only a $500 fine, folks, but there's a mandatory disqualification. And we're going to have, I'm concerned about a lot of very angry owners who are going to lose purses as we and train as we try to blend into this new system. And I think we need to try to avoid that. And I think the problem is that with all this legal confusion now, because we don't know where we are, these rules go into effect January 1 unless they're relaxed by the FTC. We could have compliance problems.
Let me get Joe Applebaum to react to that. Joe, from a practical application and in terms of meeting with the New York Horsemen, for those that don't remember or aren't aware, Joe, the head of NYTHA, the New York Thoroughbred Horsemen's Association, and what's the reaction? What's the Belmont backstretch feeling? How aware are horsemen about these standards and the changes? And what kind of communication are you employing?
So far, we've been holding off because of the influx nature of the situation, and we don't want to go down a road
and then have to change paths.
So we're holding. I feel like Ramon Dominguez on a horse sitting Chili. Yeah, we're just holding. We have all the documentation. We're aware of it, but we haven't really reached out to our horsemen yet because we want to see what the situation is, how it's going to unfold. So I want to reiterate, though, I think especially in New York and the Mid-Atlantic, and I don't want to sound like a, you know, an East Coast...
East Coast bias!
Exactly. I was definitely more a Biggie guy than Tupac, but... I'm sure none of your listeners actually understand
that reference.
Of course
they do. Plenty do.
Okay. Only Chuck, maybe. But I think in New York and most of our surrounding states, most of our THA states, it's going to be a very similar procedure and very similar outcomes to what we're currently doing. So I'm not overwhelmingly concerned about that. I think a lot of the HISA rules are kind of, to be honest, have been drafted with us in mind as a model. So I actually feel pretty good about that process. Are there, if it goes into effect, will there be hiccups? For sure.
It's going to go into effect, correct? I mean, they're going to start...
No one knows.
Well, they're going to act no matter what happens legally in the short term, and they're going to start this January 1st, correct?
It's a bit of a catch-22. And look, the HISA staff are mandated by statute to enforce the law. The law goes into effect unless the FTC decides to relax that requirement, as they did with the safety program. It goes into effect January 1. The practical problem is that the mandate from the Fifth Circuit, if it comes down on January 10th and without a stay, then at least with respect to several states, stops HISA. You may get something from the Sixth Circuit. And I think the concern for everybody could be that if HISA starts enforcing, that there's going to be a lot of litigation because people will challenge any decision of HISA or HISA stewards based on the fact that they are going to argue that the law is unconstitutional. They'll pick their spots in jurisdictions that are not covered by the Fifth and Sixth Circuits. So new litigation will start to go through. And ultimately, if there is a determination that HISA is unconstitutional, all of those decisions where they took purses away during that interim are subject to challenge because there was no legal basis to do it.
Oh my! I mean,
that's what really is the rub here.
Well, that basically is chaos.
That's what I said. The first comment I gave to the when you, I think it was you, yeah. asked me. Yeah. Well, I think we're in a very chaotic situation here. That the industry, I think the industry wants something like this. You know, that as I said, the devil was always in the details, but the kind of confusion that we have right now, and Joe and I talk about it all the time. And for those who don't know, Joe is also president of the Thoroughbred Horsemen's Association. Joe's a rising, he's a star in this business. I call him a rising star. But
I'm a little old to be a rising star.
But
I might have risen already. you're an unleavened star.
Yeah. But you know, if Heisa goes down, Steve, because we've talked about this, what happens
right.
to the regulation of the industry if it goes down? And I sense that we're going to be a far worse place. I mean, we went down this road because our business model, our business was severely threatened when the horses went down at Santa Anita. It was a game changer. And if we can't have a situation that's going to give this industry comfort that we've addressed the problems and that from a national scope, that we are doing right by our horses, and we get into something where we have groups of tracks who are going to do one thing, and we're going to have groups of states that are going to do another thing, we're going to be worse off than we were before we started with Heisa.
Yeah, let me pick up on what Alan's saying, because this, I think, is a really important point that people are missing. You ask me, what does the backstretch of Belmont say? Here's what they say. We want continuity, and we clearly want to know what the rules are. Tell us what the rules are. These are like key points that our horsemen, and I'm talking about trainers, are talking about. They want understanding, and they want it simple, and they don't want the rules in New York to be different from New Jersey, Maryland, Delaware, Pennsylvania, California, Louisiana, wherever. So these are important things. So let's think, and this is a little more philosophical than maybe the Steve Bick Show is used to, okay? But that's not true, okay? But let's think this through for a second. No one who wants to go back to the state racing commissions. Anyone? No one I know. Okay? There was great displeasure with that. Right? So, and let's be honest, why are the state racing commissions even in this business?
Well,
they don't regulate football, basketball, baseball.
Well, those sports aren't 225 years old. And that grew up in an era and that have been producing revenue for the states since 1900.
You were correct. Rob Williams, hold up. You're correct. Rob Williams, the executive director of the New York State Gaming Commission, will tell you the reason we're in this business is because in 1935, horse racing produced something like 5 to 10% of the revenue for New York State. Well, today we produce not even 5/10 of 1% of the revenue. And we have this thing called sports wagering. Right, so you can't even say, well, people are gambling on. So what are they even doing in this business? They don't want to be in this business. They can't say that publicly. They don't want to. They have lotteries to function, casinos now, sports wagering. Why are they doing it?
Why? Because there's the patronage system, and certainly New York is the crowning jewel in that realm.
I would actually tell you, in my opinion, the New York State Gaming Commission is understaffed, not overstaffed.
I'm talking about OTB.
Okay, well, that's the OTB was a disaster. Let's okay. You have me at OTB. we could do a whole show about the OTB system. But the New York State Gaming Commission is clearly understaffed for the amount of things they have to do. So, and I don't really want to talk about them. I want to talk philosophically, why are states in this business, right? We're either an adult sport that can manage itself, or we're not, right? Yeah. And we're either going to do it or we're not.
So, you know, Steve, I brought this book down for you a colleague of mine asked me to read. I was actually interviewed for the book. It's called The Fast Ride, Spectacular Bid, The Undoing of a Sure Thing. It's kind of an insider's book. If you really don't understand the business or don't know the business, you might not enjoy the book as much as those who understand the business. But the point is, and you go back, I got to go back 40 years, you know, racing had no competition. If you wanted to gamble in this country, you either went to Las Vegas or you bet on the horses. And people loved to gamble, and so racing became a state-sanctioned, state-regulated sport for those that wanted to get into the gambling business. It's a different ballgame now. You know, our business is interstate. we have so much competition for the gambling dollar now that we're just, you know, a part of the landscape. And, you know, in today's world with social media and the way that sports is looked at, people don't understand how we can have one set of rules in one state and one in another, and you're watching it on TV, and one guy can, you know, get a penalty in one state and go to another state and he can race. And, you know, it contrary to every other sport, and that's what we're wrestling with. Superimposed on top of that, the issue we've had with the safety and welfare of our horses. And, you know, we thought 4 years ago we were threatened with being forced out of business.
Yeah, look, there's been solutions. I got to jump out to a thing, so I don't want to give Alan more time. You need something that provides continuity. You need something.
No one argues that.
You need something, as the guy say, drive the cheaters out of the game, right? You know, that's some kind of loose lip service people say, and they don't want to actually reconcile with what that means on the ground. Right? To, hey, if you're going to drive them out and they're currently misbehaving, you're going to need tougher rules, not easier rules, right? But no one really wants that. But, and I'd like to give one example of how this benefits us. In New York and most of the Mid-Atlantic jurisdiction, we put in pretty tough void claim rules a few years ago.
Right.
And to be honest, at the time, there was a lot of backlash from our backside. People didn't understand it. They liked the old system. There's often inconsistencies with what vets see, right? But, Steve, you ask Gary, could he claim a horse in Saratoga this year? No, he could not. We had over 20 claims that have more than 30 slips dropped on them in Saratoga.
Tough. Absolutely.
You can't claim horses. Why is that? Because people have confidence. They have confidence in what they're buying now, right? So here's a rule that was a tougher rule that was not always everyone didn't like, but it created confidence in our system so owners and trainers could feel that they could go in on a horse. And now we have a more healthy and more robust claiming system in New York, and it's often those claiming races that those people who participate in say, well, these rules are against us. Well, no, that rule, it raised the bar, but it actually made that end of the business more vibrant.
No doubt. There's no doubt.
And whether it's HISA, not HISA, this, that, the other, that is the approach this business, this industry, this sport, because we're a sport, this is the approach this sport needs. I'd like to sign off. I have to go to a meeting, many meetings here. And I will tell you, it was not this weekend. It was the weekend before, but it's Sweet Lou's Got Aces. Won the stake as a maiden, sold from off the hook. A beautiful Constitution filly, and it only cost you $60,000. Where were you people? Okay.
What did I tell you?
Always be closing.
Exactly. Glengarry Glen Ross, one of the greatest plays ever.
ABC, Joe Applebaum, everybody, off the hook. And he is, in fact, off the hook. Come stand by Alan so I can get a picture with the two of you together. I missed a beautiful opportunity to get a picture of Mary Scalay showing her appreciation for Alan. There we go. Beautiful. Joe Applebaum, everybody, from NYTHA and off the hook. Speaking of which, by the way, Mid-Atlantic, the last sale of the year today, thinking about, I wonder if Joe's got anything involved on the consignment side.
And they've I want to say one thing to follow up on something Alan just mentioned about what happens if HISA goes away and we lose the continuity. I had a racing secretaries. We had a racing secretaries meeting yesterday, and a lot of new people for me that, you know, are coming up. And I had some conversations with one of them. I'm not going to mention the state involved, and we talked about that very thing. Like, what if HISA goes away? And they were telling me, oh my God, I don't know what we're going to do because we don't really have a pre-race test system. And I was like, excuse me. What do you mean? They don't test their horses, but, you know, jog them up and down before the races. And they're going, boy, I sure hope that if HISA does go away, that we institute some kind of rule. And they were worried that I don't think we're going to. What are we going to do?
So what we do in the Mid-Atlantic, and Steve knows this well, is we developed the Mid-Atlantic strategic plan to reduce equine fatalities. The entire Mid-Atlantic participates in that. It's there is no effort similar to it in the United States. We have a set of best practices. We have a set of rules. They're not binding rules, but we do a report card twice a year to see how the jurisdictions are doing with what we call a gap analysis. And there are about 50, 60 items on that gap analysis, and we keep a scorecard to see how everybody's doing. We've been able to significantly reduce the number of fatalities in the region by following this plan. It is what HISA follows, and that will be there whether HISA goes away or not.
And that's a great example of a region taking control of their own situation. And if it comes down to it, maybe that's what's going to have to happen if HISA's not there. Regionally,
because
states are going to have to come up with rules that, you know, that matter.
Our horsemen want uniformity. And they want uniformity, particularly in the Mid-Atlantic, because you've got New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, West Virginia, all running at the same time. How fair is it to horsemen to go from one state to another and to have to follow a different set of rules and a different set of standards? That's where all this push for uniformity that I live comes from. It may not be as important in Louisiana or in Texas, but in the Mid-Atlantic, it's critical to have that.
Well, and Florida, which has no discernible...
Right, commission. And Florida started to participate with us in the Mid-Atlantic, and we other jurisdictions around the country are following what we do. We're meeting next week. We're going to look at... our big meeting is always in March, but we're going to take a look at how we did this year, and we're going to start talking about, okay, everybody tell us what is about HISA that you're having heartburn with. Let's see if we can help to fix it.
Well, you know, I'm going to refer back to our meeting we had yesterday. We had Ann McGovern in. She was very gracious enough to come in and, you know, I said, look, it's not going to be a setup here. But we wanted you to know that, you know, everything that you do, whether it's talking about crops or drugs or anything, filters down to the bottom of the barrel, which is the racing department, has to deal with anything that comes down. And we mentioned the uniformity, too. We have an idea to use HISA as an advantage in a couple of situations where, just what you mentioned, when people travel around, okay, I've been racing 30 days, what do I have to do? Well, you got to work a half mile here. Oh, you're three quarters. Oh, you're 5/8. Claiming jail, 28 days, 30 days, 25 days. So we said, look, if we can come up with a list of 7, 8, 9 things that we can just agree on as a whole, say, okay, you got to work a half mile, and within 30 days, and that's the rule everywhere. Yeah, claiming jails, 28 days everywhere, you can still have your own underlying rules regarding that. If we can come up with some rules, will you sign off on it, and boom, it becomes a law everywhere. We can use them as an advantage to do just what you're saying. So when horsemen go from state to state, there's too many times we've seen it that horse ships into run, and all of a sudden you go, well, you only worked a half mile, you're supposed to work 5/8, so you got to be kidding me. And you got to scratch the horse, or, you know, little situations like that. So, as you're saying, if we could use them as an advantage to make some rules the same, it would make it easier on the horsemen.
Rick, it's easier said than done. I've been doing this for a long time, and I go to these meetings, and they say, oh, yeah, we've got to do it. Let's come up with a set of standards. But there's always an outlier, or it's just difficult who's going to write it up and who's going to agree to it, which is why we did the plan. There's another option, and that is a compact. And I had developed the compact.
The compact was had a lot of momentum and a lot of things was achieved.
It was to prevent HISA from happening. And now I think people are having buyer's remorse because they see that, you know what, and I've heard it from very significant jurisdictions, if we had done the compact, we would have avoided all this expense,
yep,
and all this heartache and all this litigation. And by the way, the compact exists. I mean, it only took two states to form the compact. Maryland, Delaware passed it. We've just never gone beyond it because we couldn't get number. The biggest problem was the standardbred industry blocked the ability to get the compact legislation passed in a number of states, such as Pennsylvania and New York.
Have you tried to sell your regional deal? To, you know, around the country.
Sure. Oh God,
we did
yes.
Oh my God, that was
the compact. Well, I mean, and let's not pretend there weren't successes, including the way in which steroids were eradicated in 18 months.
That came out of the Mid-Atlantic. Here's your textbook example. It started in the Mid-Atlantic, and they were going to move very quickly, and the experts said, you know what, so many of these horses are on steroids that if you're going to shut down the use of steroids, you better take it, do it over a period of time and let these horses get it through their system. So I took a lot of heat for suggesting that the steroid ban be delayed, but it turned out to be, I think, the right decision. And it, you look back now, they've been eliminated from the business. So there is the ability to do it. There is the ability to do things collectively. And if, and I will tell you, if HISA does fall of its own weight or if it's ruled unconstitutional, we're now talking the compact again just to be ready to go if we, if something needs to happen. We're advising states, go to your state legislatures, get the compact language passed. It's not controversial. And have it as a fallback if, you know, HISA should fail.
How, one update I haven't asked for in ages, because we, the RMTC conversations, we kind of backed off them a little bit because of what was in the works. But in terms of the model rules and NUMP and those initiatives that were knocking dominoes down, Alan, one jurisdiction at a time on a steady basis, how complete are those projects?
With the exception of the multiple medication violation system, which has been so fabulously successful and is part of HISA, I happen to think that's one of the best of the four prongs. Most all states are following NUMP. There are only a handful that are really not following it. So it's just a shame. That's always been the problem, Steve. There's always been a handful of states that have refused to go along with uniformity. And we're paying for all of this because of the refusal of some states to let somebody else make the decisions or follow some uniform guidelines, because they've always felt they do it better than what the other guy does. That's why I think uniformity is extraordinarily difficult to achieve.
Are you comfortable singling out who has been?
Well, we all know Louisiana. I think it's
tough.
An easy one.
Yeah. Although there seem to be, in recent years, there seem to be some softening and some coming to the table from Louisiana.
They don't have an accredited laboratory. I mean,
which is nuts considering the university system in the state.
If I were a horseman in Louisiana and I have not been following the guidelines and HISA goes into effect on January 1, I would be very nervous, because I think that's where you may see problems, because they're just following a different set of rules. I could probably pinpoint others, but the fact of the matter is, West Virginia is part of the Mid-Atlantic plan, but West Virginia in a number of areas, when we went to the 48-hour non-steroidal, they didn't want to do it.
West Virginia has got some issues on this front, too, and in a different way. In fact, Hammer kind of alluded to something that I guess you could reference. There is not a coherent pre-race vet exam program at Charlestown or Mountaineer.
Well, you know, we have that as part of the Mid-Atlantic plan.
So why aren't they participating?
Well, we talked to them. One of the problems they have in West Virginia is they don't have the personnel. They can't get the personnel. You know, you got to have veterinarians available to do inspections. You've got to be able to hire people. Mountaineer, it's a nightmare.
They've got plenty of money.
Mountaineer has been, well, you still have to have people, you know, the
qualified people.
The veterinary community that want to do large animal and want to do racetrack regulatory work is very, very small. Okay, aren't a lot of people interested in getting into this part of the business? It's not.
This doesn't make any sense. We can't go. We can't go to Texas? Not Texas Tech, or maybe it is Texas Tech. Yeah, we can't go to A&M. Thank you. Or to Penn State and go and recruit.
They'll tell you in the vet schools there aren't people in vet schools who are looking to do this kind of work. I mean, it's, you really have to go down to the foundations to get it, and that's a major problem for HISA, is the personnel that they're going to need to carry out the kinds of examinations, inspections. And I don't blame HISA. We all have the same problem. Go out to Mountaineer. And let me tell you something. The folks at Mountaineer have really bent over backwards. If there has been substantial improvement in equine health, safety, and welfare, that's one area where you can see massive changes because of their participation in the Mid-Atlantic Strategic Plan. It's kind of peer pressure, but they'll tell you, we can't get an equine medical director. We can't get a regulatory vet. They're not out there. They don't want to come live in that area. They don't want to work in that area. I think everybody is suffering that problem. It doesn't matter where you are. That is a massive problem for the industry. And it's one thing we've pointed out to HISA is it's great to have all of these recommendations, rules, regulations, and like, are you going to have the personnel to do it? And a whole other layer of problem is that under HISA, if the racing commissions don't cooperate, HISA has to go out and hire all the personnel that the racing commissions
right.
have historically provided. That's something else that was not well thought out. But
Alan is 100% right. Yep. Racetracks, when you are involved in racetracks, we get calls all the time. Hey, do you know of a vet? Do you know of a vet can do this? Do you know a vet can do that? It's a total different, you know, world of its own, you know, from small animal to this, to working at a racetrack and being a vet and the responsibilities you have, you know, you're dealing with people more than you're dealing with animals sometimes.
It's very high stress. It's very high pressure. And, yep. you know, look, you run the risk of regulatory violations and litigation and potential suspensions. And, you know, you could be called before your state veterinary board. I mean, there's a lot that goes on. You got to really, really want to do this. You got to really love it. And it's got to be lucrative, which it's in today's world where people don't want to work.
Let me fill out, we got about 10 minutes to the top of the hour. Let me get back to one element that came up and is really central to, you know, with the Mary Scalet piece. And those that haven't seen it, it's at TDN. And Dan Ross, who really is terrific, and he and Matt Hegarty, Frank Angst, I mean, they're a big shout-out to the very dedicated, even-handed reporting from the trades, for the most part. You mentioned getting the nefarious types extricated. What exactly in this proposed approach that we reference the detection times and screening limits, how is that going to be any different than what is done now with withdrawal guidelines? And I know that, you know, from a testing standpoint, they're doing out of competition. They've got a different mentality and a different approach. There's actually going to be way less testing of race winners and of random horses pulled at you know, just at random. They've got a different approach, which is okay, except how is this any more vibrant and any better if you're not getting to the undetected, you know, potential? I understand the steroidal stacking, the you know, that approach can minimize that or eliminate it. That kind of thing I get. Even the steroid stuff, out of competition, etc. How are we in any better place with this cumbersome system and frankly punitive system, potentially, for unsuspecting and unprepared vets, owners, and trainers? How are we any better off than where we are now, where, a reminder, it still took five stones and wiretaps to get the poster boys for sure. Nefariousness?
Well, look, it's we're early in the game, and HISA has not built out its enforcement. I wouldn't call it its enforcement powers, but its whole investigative team and how they're going to approach it. At the end of the day, it's still going to be boots on the ground. It's going to be calls to hotlines. It's going to be however they want to approach it. But by the way, we don't have that in horse racing right now. We did it one time. And, you know, we've talked about mm-hmm. this, the Thoroughbred Racing Protective Bureau, and maybe they can recreate that dynamic.
Paul Berube.
So that horsemen know that there is an entity out there that is watching. Look, you're always going to have these instances of nefarious conduct. You look at the history of the business.
Of course.
And it happens in every sport, and I don't care how strictly you regulate what you do or otherwise. You can look at the NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball. You will have them.
Don't limit it to sport. Wall Street, real estate, every walk of life where money and commissions and, please.
International sports. But look, the benefit of HISA is twofold. Number one, you're going to have one set of rules and one set of the manner in which this is all going to be adjudicated, which is not state by state now, or you can go to a racing commission. If you know a racing commissioner, they'll give you a break, or in one state it's a $50 fine, in another it's a 15-day suspension. Everybody's going to be on a level playing field. And there are a lot of horsemen, owners, trainers, and the like who like that. The second thing is that we have never been successful in doing, and HISA can help us with, is HISA breaks medications into two categories, the doping drugs and the controlled medications that we use on a daily basis. And since HISA is going to be the enforcement power, when people want to criticize our business and say that Alan Foreman doped a horse because he had a positive test for phenylbutazone, and boy, does that sound bad? You know, they're going to say, this is routine medication treatment. This has nothing to do with doping. This is not a doping substance. This deals with the health, safety, and welfare of the horse. We have guidelines to ensure that we protect the horse going into the horse when it's going into the starting gate. And this is all related to health, safety, and welfare. You know, it's almost like the traffic ticket as opposed to drunk driving. So that's what HISA, I think, can best do for us. Is we're going to have somebody independently who can speak to the press, who can speak to the public, and put a different color on the way we do. You know, these are animals that get treated on a daily basis.
It's still going to take investigative services.
Yes.
To catch anybody that is utilizing. Don't call them medications. Call them performance-enhancing drugs. It's
deterrence, Steve. Who doesn't spend a lot of money for deterrence? You know, hoping either nothing ever happens or maybe nothing will happen. But it's all about deterrence. Yeah, you got to have it.
No doubt. And
we're going to pay a lot of money for it.
By the way, we've got an hour without one mention of where are we with the funding.
Well, where we are is that we all have bills for assessments that are required by the statute that have to be paid. I think one of the problems is HISA has developed its budget based on if they have to take over the entire regulation of the industry. If, for example, racing commissions don't cooperate, so you have to pay for them to hire personnel, you have to pay for drug testing, you have to pay for a lot of stuff, and they've built it all into a very bloated budget, and they got to be able to pay their bills. We're paying for litigation. It's not pretty. On a personal level, we probably won't continue the match series because the amount of money that the horsemen's groups and the tracks are going to have to pay for HISA went into a luxury like the match series. And when you have to make choices, HISA's not a choice. HISA's a mandatory requirement. So, you know, we're going to sit back until we get some clarity here as to what happens. But, you know, take Penn National announced last week they're cutting days, they're cutting purses. Then you superimpose on top of that their HISA payment, and match series doesn't look so attractive to them right now. So, unfortunately, there'll be casualties, but I think the regulation of the sport and the oversight's more important than marketing.
At least in the short term.
In the short term. Listen, I did match, we suspended. I did match, we suspended. I did match again. You know.
That could be a
it's like herpes,
smaller
it comes
match.
And goes, right?
So, interestingly enough, Alan and I go way back at the beginning of the match series, as a matter of fact.
The Hammer was one of the first.
We wrote the rules. It was a great thing. Now, and curiously, are the states involved in the that are in your little consortium there, are the same states that are in the match? So
right.
And probably interestingly enough, the match series probably brought you guys together.
It was. The whole point was to bring about uniformity, jointly market, try to get the. You talked about a racing secretary's meeting where you talk about how to work together. That was the whole idea, was to bring the region to work together. And oh, by the way, why don't we market it with an event that would showcase the region?
Right.
And that's what it did.
And now it brought the teams together, so to speak, on another level, and you've been able to do this. So,
and Steve, you were a great supporter of Match. We always appreciate that, and If we continue, you know, you'll be at the table with us.
What you've done, obviously, and I've come to one of the meetings of the Mid-Atlantic, which was fascinating, you know, to really see, you know, a region and a big portion of, you know, of racing's entity working, you know, cohesively. It's very encouraging.
It's to get the focus off all this nonsense, isn't the right word, but all this noise, and focus on what we're here for. And that's the beauty of the animal, the greatness of horse racing, and the colorful people who, you know, make up this industry, from owners to backstretch people to jock. I mean, it's an incredible, incredible business. Nothing like it.
There's nothing like an Alan Foreman.
It's a treasure,
and he's at a treasure. He's writing his own description. This was great. I mean, I undoubtedly, you know, the people that have listened get a much greater understanding, comprehension of where things stand, what is at stake, what has to happen going forward, and as I have long established as one of the show's watch words or phrases, to quote LBJ, don't spit in the soup, we've all got to eat it.
Great line.
Alan Foreman, everybody.
Thanks, Steve.
Opportunity to get chapter and verse on exactly where things stand. And, of course, it all can change tomorrow with oral arguments in front of the Sixth Circuit. So we'll see where it goes. Hammer with me. It's top of the hour. We're going to take our first break of two. And when we come back, we'll see. There is the keynote action that's going to start here. And so I'm sure there'll be quite a few people heading right into the ballroom. But we actually got a couple of reach-outs, too. For that reason, Danny Gargan, Todd Pletcher, a graduate of the University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program, and Graham Motion. So we'll get three trainer visits in that were unavailable yesterday to sort of fill in the blanks while everybody takes in Mike Mulvihill and Lisa Lazarus and so much more. Hammer and I will go over a bunch of the activities for today. After we take this break, and I think Adam Koenig is going to join us as well from Kentucky. Looking forward to talking to him. And, of course, he completely, almost with Pat Cummings' help and direction, almost single-handedly responsible for Kentucky adopting a zero breakage policy. It was Adam's initiative, as you know. Let's take this break. When we come back, we'll talk to Adam Koenig, Danny Gargan, much more. We're live at the University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program Symposium on Gaming. SiriusXM at the Races, back after this.
It's At the Races with Steve Bick on SiriusXM Radio. Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're